Chapter 10 Together Again. I was still on cloud nine from winning that first championship when the call came in late July from C.M. Newton, the athletic director at the University of Kentucky. I was about to climb even higher. Newton, who would soon be the president of USA Basketball, asked if I was interested in being one of the 12 players to participate in the 1992 Summer Olympics in Barcelona, Spain. Was I interested? This wasn't just any basketball team, mind you. These 12 players would become known forever as the Dream Team, the first time NBA stars were allowed to compete in the Olympics. Other countries had been relying on professionals for years. Why shouldn't we? The final straw came at the 1988 games in Seoul, Korea, when the U.S. squad, coached by Georgetown's John Thompson and featuring outstanding college players such as David Robinson, Danny Manning, and Stacey Augman, was forced to settle for a bronze medal after losing to the Soviet Union. People were furious. The U.S. basketball team doesn't lose in the Olympics, and certainly not to the Russians. Unless, as in 1972, something funny is going on. I said yes to Newton in record time. I didn't want to give the man an opportunity to change his mind. I was surprised he called. I'm not suggesting I wasn't worthy. Quite the opposite. I was one of the top players in the game. Except I had been in the league for just 4 years and made only one All-Star team. There were others with more impressive credentials. I only wish my father was still around. Having served his country in World War II, he would have been proud of me. Once I returned to Earth, Newton and I chatted for a while about some of the logistics. If the Bulls made it to the finals again, a strong possibility, I would have practically no time off before having to show up at training camp in La Jolla, California. The games would begin on July 25th. So be it. This wasn't some exhibition in Peoria. This was the Olympics. If necessary, I would go from Grant Park directly to O'Hare. I asked Newton, for vastly different reasons, if either Michael Jordan or Isaiah Thomas would be on the team. Michael has a spot, he said. He just hasn't committed yet. Newton asked me to keep our chat a secret until the committee could issue a formal announcement. No problem, I said. I won't say a word. Unless I'm mistaken, the only person I told right away was my brother Billy, who shared the news with the rest of the family. I trusted them 100%. Shortly afterward, however, while the committee was still putting the team together, I approached Michael. I couldn't keep quiet a moment longer. I told him about the call from Newton. "Are you going to be on the Dream Team?" I asked. "I don't know yet," Michael said. "I'm thinking about it." I had once asked Michael the same question after we learned the United States would use professionals in Barcelona. "Are you kidding me?" he said then. "I already have a gold medal. I want to enjoy my summer." He played for Bobby Knight at the 1984 games in Los Angeles. In the end, Michael decided to join the team. Not because he felt a sudden sense of duty to Uncle Sam. He played to help grow the game, and let's be frank, his brand. Two of his biggest corporate sponsors, McDonald's and Gatorade, would also be sponsoring the games. The optics would have been awful if he had stayed home. As for Isaiah, I asked Newton because here was someone I hoped would be staying home. "No, he won't be on the team," Newton told me. And that was all he had to say on the matter. That was enough. In late September, the Dream Team was finally announced. It would include me, Michael, Patrick Ewing, David Robinson, Larry Bird, Charles Barkley, Magic Johnson, John Stockton, Karl Malone, and Chris Mullin. Two additional players were to be chosen at a later date, one from the NBA, one from college. They'd end up being Clyde Drexler and the kid from Duke, Christian Laettner. I agreed with each pick except Laettner. I didn't think he would fit in, and I was right. The committee should have chosen another NBA player, and plenty were worthy. My preference was Dominique Wilkins, otherwise known as the human highlight reel. Dominique was only 31 and still at the top of his game. Much has been written over the years about why Isaiah didn't make the team. What is true without a doubt is that a number of guys wouldn't have participated if he had been selected, Michael and me included. Newton and other members of the committee knew how we felt. Not even Chuck Daly, the team's head coach, and Isaiah's coach since 1983, lobbied for him. What does that tell you? Looking at his numbers, it would be difficult to argue Isaiah wasn't deserving. He was a 10-time All-Star, a 2-time champion, and a sure Hall of Famer. Except putting a basketball team together is about more than numbers. It is about chemistry. And with Isaiah on the Dream Team, the chemistry would have been horrible. I couldn't wait for the games to begin. First, there was another season to get through, and another shock to absorb. The news came from Los Angeles on Thursday, November 7th. Magic Johnson had been diagnosed with HIV. He said he would immediately retire. Just 5 months earlier, we faced him and the Lakers in the NBA Finals. He couldn't have looked any healthier. Now he was dying. At least, that's what we feared. I was devastated. I wished I could have spoken to him, to believe he would get through this, to believe we would get through this. Magic and I didn't enjoy that kind of relationship. He came into the league 8 years before I did. 8 years is a generation in the National Basketball Association. To me, him contracting the virus was another reminder of how quickly everything can be taken away. Not that I needed any more. I just had to think of my own family. No one displayed a pure love for the game as enthusiastically and as genuinely as Magic Johnson did, then or ever since. As incredible as he was on the court, I admire him more for how he has conducted himself off the court. A death sentence? Hardly. There is no one I've ever met who was more alive. We knew so little about AIDS in those days. Ironically, just a week before, Phil had stressed the importance of being careful with members of the opposite sex. A few guys made jokes, as young men tend to do in these kinds of conversations. There were no jokes this time. Everyone was concerned. Like many people, they assumed only homosexuals contracted the virus. Now that it had claimed Magic Johnson, the epitome of heterosexuality, it dawned on them AIDS could claim anyone. About a week later, there was more news from off the court. A new book, The Jordan Rules, chronicling our championship season, hit the shelves. To this day, I haven't read one word of Sam Smith's book, and I won't. I don't need to read it. I lived it. Besides, I've heard so often what's in there, I feel as if I have read it. That Michael had a fight with Will Perdue, that Michael didn't want any of us to pass the ball to Bill Cartwright in crunch time, that Michael met with a psychic when he went through a shooting slump, etc., etc., etc. I made the last one up. The book blew things way out of proportion. The tensions that were spelled out between players and between players and management are there on every team, in every season. The only reason this particular account was newsworthy can be summed up in two words: Michael Jordan. As for who the sources might have been, a topic of much speculation over the years, I don't buy for a second that it was primarily Horace, as Michael suggested in The Last Dance. Sam Smith, who covered the team for the Chicago Tribune, picked up his juicy tidbits from a number of players and coaches and from people affiliated with the organization. And yes, that included Jerry Krause. Doesn't make sense, does it? Jerry was known for keeping information from reporters, not the other way around. And what about the reports he was so outraged by what came out in the book that he marked up dozens of sections he felt were blatant lies? None of that changes my opinion one bit. Think about it. Jerry spent years trying to assemble a championship roster, and now that his dream had come to fruition, he wasn't getting the credit. Michael was. Jerry was the most insecure man I ever met. It made him work hard and become an excellent general manager. It also made him petty and vindictive. So he decided to take Michael down. Just a notch. Jerry assumed he could control what Sam wrote. That was his mistake. He had been around the media long enough to know better. In any case, the book didn't take Michael down. Not even close. Okay, so he wasn't a saint. Who is? He was the most beloved athlete in the world, except for maybe Muhammad Ali. Nothing in a reporter's tell-all book was going to change that. Nor, for that matter, did it take the team down. Quite the opposite, and that was because of Phil. Phil was always able to make us believe it was us against the world, especially after we won our first championship. That's what happens when you become the best. People want to destroy you. We often felt as if we were fighting members of our own organization and the media as much as we were fighting the other teams. The book turned out to be a blessing. From then on, we were more guarded with what we said to one another and to the press, sparing us, no doubt, further controversy. Not that Michael was thrilled with everything reported in the book. He didn't speak to Sam for the longest time. I didn't blame Michael one bit. If I had been in his position, I might not have spoken to Sam ever again. Sam, to be fair, was no different from the other members of the Fourth State, always on the prowl for the next victim. Michael had been through a lot that fall already. In early October, the team visited the White House to be honored by President George Bush. It was pretty cool, I have to admit. Meeting the leader of the free world was something I never imagined myself doing. There was one notable no-show, Michael, which wasn't a problem until Horace made it a problem. Larry Bird skipped a similar visit in 1984, and I don't remember it leading to the end of Western civilization. I'm very disappointed because it was a great honor for the whole city of Chicago, as well as the Bulls organization, Horace said. Not to have your best player and your team leader there is just like sending somebody else besides George Bush to Saudi Arabia. Now, I think the world of Horace, always have, and I understood how much the double standard that Doug, and to some extent Phil, allowed to exist between Michael and the rest of the team bothered him. Only here was an occasion, and there were certainly others, where he should have kept his opinion to himself. The season had yet to begin. Michael had earned the right to do whatever he wanted with his own time. That included not going to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Before long, Michael and Horace made up, and the whole episode was forgotten. Except to serve as another reminder that, now that we were the champions, every minor incident had the potential to become a major story. The challenges we faced in the 1991-92 season were formidable. That's always the case when you're trying to defend a title. Will guys work as hard? Will they keep putting the team above themselves? Will they complain about their contracts? Most important, will they remain healthy? During the 90-91 season, 10 players on our roster appeared in at least 73 games. Four, Michael, me, Paxson, and BJ, in all 82 games. That was incredibly good fortune and would never happen today. Load management? The term didn't exist in the early 90s. There was more to it than pure luck. We spaced the floor and didn't find ourselves in too many collisions, at least of our own doing, and when someone did get injured, it was taped up and back on the court in no time. Phil came up with a slogan for every season. The year before, it was commitment. This time, it was together again. Together indeed. In addition to signing me to the 5-year extension, the Bulls inked deals with Cartwright and Paxson, both in their 30s, which showed the organization's faith in keeping our core group intact. Phil didn't like to make a ton of changes in personnel. Getting new players to pick up the nuances of the triangle would take time. The only change of any real significance occurred in early November when we shipped Dennis Hobson who had never fit in, to the Sacramento Kings for 8-year veteran Bobby Hansen. Hansen was known primarily for his defense, not scoring. We had enough scorers, or so we thought. On the very same day, Craig Hodges injured his left knee when he collided with Stacey King in practice. Hodges would miss 19 games. Shortly afterward, Bill fractured his left hand and he too would be out for a while. I suppose we were due for our share of bad breaks. Early that season, I ran into my buddy, Isaiah Thomas. Same old Isaiah. He shoved me from behind for no reason during our 110-93 victory at the stadium. The teams had gotten into a near brawl. Both of us had to be restrained. I wonder if it had anything to do with his not being on the Dream Team. I didn't bother to ask. Anyway, the win was our fourth in a row, and we went on to make it 14 straight before losing on the road to the Sixers by 3 points in early December. Shortly after the first of the year, we launched another winning streak, this one coming to an end at 13 when the Spurs defeated us 109-104. David Robinson was a monster, 21 points, 13 rebounds, and 8 block shots. Our record was 37-6, and being the first team to win 70 games was within reach. Except what would that prove? They don't give out trophies for breaking the record for most wins. Better to pace ourselves, let guys get a breather every now and then, and be ready for May and June, when they do give out a trophy. Meanwhile, I was playing the best basketball of my life. In early March, I was the only player in the league in the top 15 in scoring, assists, and steals, and the only one to average more than 20 points, 7 assists, and 7 rebounds. There was talk I might win the MVP. I didn't believe it. I could have a triple-double every night, and the writers would never vote for me over Michael. Lo and behold, Michael won the award for the third time in 5 years. I came in ninth. After we finished 67-15, our opponent in the first round of the playoffs was the Miami Heat. We swept them in 3 games. Next were the New York Knicks. These weren't the same Knicks we swept the year before. Their new coach was Pat Riley, formerly of the Showtime Lakers, the owner of 4 rings. Riley, similar to Phil, was a tremendous motivator. In his first season in New York, the Knicks won 51 games, a dozen more than the year before. Their center, Patrick Ewing, was one of the toughest players we ever had to guard. He could hit the mid-range jumper and do a ton of damage in the paint. Double teams didn't seem to bother him. Oakley was another problem. Playing against Oak was like going to war. You knew he would come at you for every rebound. Their other big man, Anthony Mason, in his third year, was also a bruiser. The Knicks were essentially the new Pistons. Just our luck. We had only recently figured out how to beat the old Pistons. Even so, we were extremely confident heading into Game 1 at the stadium. Perhaps too confident. The Knicks beat us 94-89. Ewing scored 34 points, 16 in the fourth quarter, pulled down 16 rebounds, and blocked 6 shots. If losing at home wasn't upsetting enough, I also sprained my ankle. The injury would hinder me for the rest of the series. I couldn't get the normal lift on my shots, and lift is everything in basketball. In Game 2, I finished 2-for-12, scoring only 6 points. I hadn't played this poorly in a playoff game since the migraine. Fortunately, we prevailed 86-78 to square the series. In Game 3, I bounced back, sprained ankle or not, with 26 points, including 12 in the fourth quarter, as we won in the Garden 94-86 to regain home court advantage. New York took Game 4 93-86, and the series was even again. Phil was thrown out late in the third quarter after getting on the officials for allowing the Knicks to push Horace and me around. The new Pistons indeed. Between Games 4 and 5, another battle raged. This one was in the press between the two coaches. Phil started it. In his post-game interview at the Garden, still fuming, he went after the NBA. "I think they're probably licking their chops on Fifth Avenue," Phil said, referring to the league's headquarters in New York. "I don't like orchestration. It sounds fishy, but they do control who sends the referees. If it goes 7 games, everybody will be really happy. Everybody will get the TV revenue and ratings they want." The next day, Riley responded. He was no wallflower. The fact that he's whining and whimpering about the officiating is an insult to how hard our guys are playing and how much our guys want to win. Those were the days, weren't they? The team split the next 2 games to set up a deciding Game 7 at the stadium. The pressure was on us entirely. After losing just 15 times the entire regular season, we were now suddenly 1 loss from being eliminated. The Knicks, on the other hand, had already exceeded expectations by forcing a Game 7. The pressure was on me as well. In the series so far, I was averaging less than 16 points and was shooting only 37% from the field. During the regular season, I averaged 21 points and shot 51%. Robin to Michael's Batman, I was acting more like the Riddler. From game to game, no one knew what to expect from number 33, me included. Speaking of villains, the Knicks had a real one, the bald-headed small forward Xavier McDaniel. The X-Man, as he was called, had been pushing me around the whole series, and we let him get away with it. Not anymore. With about 3 minutes to go in the first quarter of Game 7, McDaniel was called for an offensive foul. As the teams headed down the court, he and I exchanged a few words. I don't recall the nature of our conversation. Let's just say I wasn't asking him about his plans for the summer. That's when Michael came over and got right in McDaniel's face, and I mean literally. If their foreheads weren't touching, they were awfully close. Both received a technical. What Michael did was as important as the 42 points he would put up that day. He was our leading scorer. He wasn't our enforcer. We hadn't had an enforcer since Oak left. For Michael to take on that role sent a powerful message to the Knicks. This is our court and our game, and we are not going to back down to you thugs for 1 second. The Knicks didn't back down either. Early in the third quarter, when they cut an 11-point deficit to 3, Phil called time. Phil didn't like to call time when the team got out of sync. He preferred the guys figure things out on their own. Except this was a Game 7. We could figure things out another time. I don't remember what he told us in the huddle. Whatever it was, it worked. We went on a run of our own and led by 15 after 3 quarters. Our defense was as stingy as ever, and we were unwilling to settle for jump shots. That the NBA appointed a veteran crew to officiate the game also helped. The final, 110-81. The Knicks gave us a much tougher challenge than we anticipated. What a relief to get them out of the way. For me, it was vindication. If that appears to be something I harp on, it's because I received constant criticism from my close friends in the press. I finished with a triple-double, 17 points, 11 rebounds, 11 assists. That shut them up, for the time being. On to the conference finals to face another familiar foe, the Cleveland Cavaliers. After winning only 33 games the year before, the Cavs, 57-25, were back to being one of the best teams in the league. They still had Brad Doherty in the post and Mark Price at the point, and had just eliminated the Celtics. Game 1 was a breeze, 103-89, as I nearly posted another triple-double, 29 points, 12 boards, 9 assists. Perhaps most encouraging was our performance from the free throw line, 19 of 19. In the Knicks series, we made only 70% of our free throws. 2 routes in a row. We were back on track for another ring. Back all right. To the drawing board. I don't have an explanation for what happened in Game 2. Except this. We stank. We missed our first 13 shots and shot only 14% in the first quarter. The Cavs were up by 26 at the half, in our building. Phil put it best. This team deserved to be booed off the floor. Fortunately, momentum can change in a hurry in the playoffs. In Game 3, it was our turn. At one point in the first quarter, the score was 26-4 in favor of the Bulls. In addition to Michael and me, Horace, 15 points, 11 rebounds, 4 blocks, Pax, 5 of 6 from the field, and Scott Williams, 10 points, 6 boards, came up big in a 105-96 victory. Having regained the home court advantage, we set out in Game 4 to dash any lingering hopes the Cavs might still harbor. Forget it. They were in control from the start, winning 99-85. Worse yet, I felt we had gone back in time. Michael took 33 shots. The other 4 starters took a total of 29. In the entire second half, I had 3 attempts. That's not a typo. I finished with 13 points. Tex must have wanted to shoot himself, or us. As usual, when we lost an important game, I took the heat. For how I played, and for having the nerve to tell the reporters when asked why I didn't score more, that I hadn't received any opportunities. They thought I was criticizing the coaches. I was not. The following day, I skipped a session with the media. Why bother? They were going to find something negative to write about me, whether I showed up or not. Once again, the pressure was on us and on me. Once again, I came through. In Game 5, I scored 14 points and pulled down a team-high 15 rebounds as we prevailed 112-89. In Game 6, we closed out the Cavs in Cleveland 99-94. My line, 29 points, 12 rebounds, 5 assists, 4 steals, 4 blocks. The 1991-92 season felt as if it had been going on forever. Magic diagnosed with HIV and having to retire, the controversy generated by the release of the Jordan rules, the games with the Knicks that were more like brawls. Yet here we were, still standing in the month of June. We couldn't ask for anything more. Chapter 11. From one dream to another. Instead of the Lakers in the NBA Finals, it was the Portland Trail Blazers. No, the Blazers didn't possess a legendary player such as a Magic Johnson or a legendary past. The franchise could boast of only one championship, 1976-77, since entering the league as an expansion team in 1970. They would probably have had more, but their star center, Bill Walton, injured his foot in 1978 and would never be the same. It wasn't long before the team, which had gotten to 50-10 at one point in the 1977-78 season, went back to what it was before Walton arrived. Irrelevant. Which was precisely the fate we hoped to avoid. The list of NBA champions includes one-hit wonders who disappeared as rapidly as they surfaced. The Blazers, who defeated the Utah Jazz in the Western Conference Finals, were more athletic than the Lakers, and they were deep, with center Kevin Duckworth, guards Terry Porter and Danny Ainge, and forwards Jerome Kersey, Cliff Robinson, and Buck Williams. Oh, and of course, there was Clyde. Clyde Drexler at 6'7" would be my man. As usual, I looked forward to the challenge. I'd studied his game for years, like I studied Magic's. Clyde was a right-handed penetrator who seldom dribbled to his left. Our mission in every playoff series, as Phil put it, was to cut off the head of the opponent's snake. On the Blazers, the snake was Clyde. He averaged 25 points that season, finishing second to MJ in the MVP race. Some put the two in the same category. As you might expect, Michael didn't like to be compared to Clyde. Michael didn't like to be compared to anyone. Ironically, the only reason he ended up with the Bulls in the first place was because the Blazers, who owned the pick ahead of them in 1984, already had Clyde, drafted the year before, and thought they didn't need a player with a similar skill set. Guess again. Anyway, in game one at the stadium, Michael wasted no time in proving his point. Watching him knock down one three-pointer after another against Clyde, I was mesmerized. He was always coming up with something we hadn't seen before. He finished with 39 points, including 6 threes, in our 122-89 triumph. Lost in his performance, which included the famous shrug after he hit his last three, was a near triple-double, 24 points, 10 assists, 9 rebounds, from yours truly, though I was just as pleased with holding Clyde to 16 points on 5 of 14 from the field. Were the Blazers overwhelmed by the moment? Perhaps. There was certainly no excuse for losing game one of the NBA Finals by 33 points. I don't care if Michael had made 16 threes. Two nights later, in game two, we outscored Portland 32-16 in the third quarter to go up by 7. With 4.5 minutes left, the lead was 10. Clyde had fouled out. Ball game. Not so fast. A layup by Kersey, a jumper by Porter, 2 free throws from Porter, a scoop shot by Ainge, another layup by Kersey. Suddenly, incredibly, it was 95-95. The game still tied with a couple of seconds to go. Michael fired from a few feet right of the foul line. No good. We were headed to OT, and to more frustration. Portland outscored us 18-7 in the extra 5 minutes to even the series. The hero was Ainge, who had half of those 18 points. The Blazers were overwhelmed by the moment, all right. All they did was score on 16 of their final 17 possessions. I couldn't, for the life of me, recall us ever blowing a lead like that in a game this big. We couldn't afford to dwell on the loss for long. Game three in Portland was only 2 days away. The year before, we needed to win at least one game in Los Angeles to keep our season alive. We won 3. There was no reason we couldn't win 3 in Portland, as long as we made the proper adjustments. Instead of pressuring their guards as they moved the ball up the court, we switched to an interior zone, forcing the Blazers to settle for long jump shots, which, to our good fortune, they didn't knock down. In game three, they shot 36% from the floor and scored just 84 points, while we put up 94. In their previous 17 playoff games, the Blazers averaged more than 113 points. 2 down, 2 to go. And now we had the momentum. Naturally, with how these up-and-down playoffs were going, the momentum didn't last. The Blazers took game four, 93-88. There were many to blame for the defeat, and I was definitely on the list. With a little over 4 minutes to go, I was on the line with a chance to extend our lead to 4 points. I missed both free throws. From then on, the Blazers outscored us 13-6 to tie the series 2-2. Enter Michael and me to the rescue. In game five, which we won 119-106, Michael scored 46 points, while I chipped in with 24 along with 11 rebounds and 9 assists. We were one angry group for letting the Blazers hang around this long. Playing angry is often when you play your best. Now it was time to put them away for good. Like everyone else, I was excited about the opportunity to close the deal on our own court. That was the only thing missing from the 1991 title. Not that we took anything for granted. The Lakers, without James Worthy, fought from start to finish in last year's elimination game. We expected the same effort from the Blazers. We got it. From the opening tip, the Blazers were the looser, more poised team. They looked as if they were trying to close us out. At halftime, we were fortunate their lead was only 6. The third quarter wasn't any better. Before we knew it, the lead was in double digits. Going into the fourth, we were down by 15. The fans were antsy. So were we. Phil sent me out with the second unit to start the quarter. The first unit didn't have it. That included Michael. Not for one moment, however, did I believe the game was over. Having played with the guys, BJ Armstrong, Bobby Hansen, Stacey King, Scott Williams, on the second unit countless times in practice, I knew what they were made of. Each player was aware of the little, I should say big, things required to win a basketball game, especially a game such as this. Taking charges, setting screens, making the extra pass. Most of all, believing in themselves and one another. The plan was to get the Blazers rattled. If we could do that, the crowd would rattle them some more. We needed to treat every possession as if it were the last at both ends. Whenever we trailed by double digits, our mindset was if we could get 5 stops in a row and score on at least 4 of our own trips, we would be right back in it. I was never one to give pep talks. That was Phil's job or Michael's. This time, I did have a suggestion. You get a shot, I told the guys in the huddle, shoot it. Bobby Hansen did just that. He nailed a 3 from the corner the first time we had the ball and followed with a steal at the other end, which led to a pivotal moment in the game involving Stacey King. Stacey, who was a star at Oklahoma, hadn't turned out to be the player we hoped he would be. Perhaps we didn't give him enough minutes, or perhaps he didn't do enough with the minutes we gave him. He had the misfortune of joining us at the precise time Horace was developing into one of the top power forwards in the NBA. I don't know what else Stacey could have done to break through. Whatever the reason, we needed him now, and he delivered. He went strong to the hoop and got hacked by Kersey. The ref signaled for a flagrant. Stacey went to the line for 2 free throws, and we would maintain possession. The crowd was loving it. After Stacey converted 1 of the 2, I scored in the lane to get us within 9. 2 possessions later, I scored inside again, and Clyde then turned it over. There were less than 10 minutes to go. Normally around this point, Phil would have put Michael back in. Not this time. The second unit was on a roll, and he didn't want to mess with it. Not yet. I wasn't shocked. Phil was never afraid to make the decision no one expected. BJ hit a jumper. After Buck Williams committed an offensive foul, Stacey followed with a jumper of his own. The Blazers were rattled indeed. The lead was only 3. With about 8.5 minutes left, Michael finally went back in. The second unit had done its job and then some. Michael, the best closer in the game, and I could take it from there. The final score, 97-93. Michael finished with 33 points, 12 in the final quarter. I added 26, going 5-for-5 in the fourth. Once it was over, I made my way to the locker room to get the party started. Without the basketball this time, one souvenir was enough. As for what this championship meant to me, it meant a lot. They all did, though I will never put one over another. Each stood out in a different way. This one stood out for what the second unit did during those crucial 3.5 minutes in the fourth quarter. Without cutting into the Portland lead the way those guys did, the game might well have been over. Who knows what would have happened in a game 7? I'm just grateful we didn't have to find out. In the locker room, as we were soaking it, in more ways than one, the word quickly got around. They aren't going home. They were the fans. Few had taken off for the exits. There was only one thing to do. Go out there and join them. I jumped on the scorer's table along with Horace and Michael. Our arms linked together. We did a little dance. We stayed out there for a half hour, maybe longer. I didn't want the night to ever end. 2 days later, on a beautiful sunny afternoon, a more formal celebration took place at Grant Park in downtown Chicago. It felt as if the whole state of Illinois was there. Several of us went to the podium to say a few words. When it was my turn, I said what I believed was on everyone's mind. Let's go for a three-peat. After the usual exit meetings with the coaching staff, everyone took off for the summer except for Michael and me. We had 1 week before reporting to camp in La Jolla. There was a gold medal to win. I remember the first day of camp very well. As I looked around at the faces of my new teammates and former and future adversaries, I couldn't quite believe my good fortune. It's one thing to hang out with these amazing players, some of them true legends during the weekend of the All-Star game. Quite another to realize we would be together for 6 weeks, on the court, off the court, everywhere. I didn't know these guys. I knew their games, yes, as well as anyone. Where they liked to catch the ball, how they defended their man, what their favorite shot was, etc., etc., etc. What I didn't know was who they were. What made them tick? What made them great? What made them human? I wondered, for instance, would they be able to check their egos at the door? Think about it. You are asking the most talented basketball players in the universe. Everyone, with the exception of Leitner, would wind up in the Hall of Fame for their individual accomplishments. Not to be selfish. Not to do what propelled them to become stars in the first place. Midway through the first practice, I stopped wondering. If anything, the guys were too unselfish, passing up one easy scoring opportunity after another to look for their teammates. One doesn't see that often. Not even in practice. Tex would have been in heaven. A couple of days later, Coach Daly put us through our first scrimmage. The opponent was a group of college players such as Bobby Hurley, Grant Hill, Chris Webber, Penny Hardaway, Allen Houston, and Jamal Mashburn. The coach was Roy Williams from the University of Kansas. These kids were extremely gifted, with bright futures in the league. Of course, they would be no match for the Dream Team. Lo and behold, the kids beat us by about 10 points. Houston hit from everywhere, and I don't remember anybody else on their team missing many shots either. Boy, were they proud of themselves afterward. You would have thought they had just won the gold medal. Some people, including our assistant coach, Duke's Mike Krzyzewski, have long believed that Coach Daly lost the game on purpose, which would explain why he didn't put the best 5 players, including Michael, on the court when the outcome was still in doubt. Coach Daly, as this theory goes, saw it as a chance to get across an important message. On any given day, if you guys don't play hard enough, anyone can beat you. The message got through loud and clear. The next day, in another scrimmage, we killed the same team by like 50 points. Let's face it, there was no way we were leaving Barcelona without the gold. We knew it, and the teams we were playing knew it, and what's more, they didn't seem to mind one bit. Their players behaved more like fans than foes. Many asked for our autographs or to have their pictures taken with us after the game. Sometimes before the game. That didn't keep every man on the Dream Team from taking his job seriously. Lots of times in the NBA, when a coach goes over a scouting report, guys, to put it kindly, don't give it their full undivided attention. That didn't happen with us. No matter the quality of the opposition, we treated every game as if it were Game 7 of the NBA Finals. As for me, I didn't care how many minutes I got. I told Coach Daly and his assistants, if you need me in crunch time, wonderful. If you need me in garbage time, that's wonderful too. At 26, the youngest player besides Leitner, I felt blessed merely to be a member of this incredibly special group. I was in paradise. When Coach Daly put Larry Bird in the starting lineup for our first game, I was on board 100%. This was Larry Bird, one of the best players of all time. In the end, I logged about 21 minutes a game, trailing only Michael and Chris Mullen. Coach Daly relied on me for defense. We had plenty of guys who could put the ball in the hole. Everyone found it refreshing to not have to be the man night after night. All they had to do was go out there and execute, and we would be up by 30 points before the first time out. I'm exaggerating, obviously. Not by much. Occasionally, certain individuals try to do too much. The person who comes to mind is Clyde Drexler. Clyde, still hurting from losing to the Bulls in the finals, was out to prove he belonged on the same level as Michael, as if the six games the teams had just played hadn't proven the exact opposite. Here is what someone should have told him. Clyde, you should feel fortunate. You are one of the best basketball players in the world. You're just not Michael Jordan, and that's no crime. No one is. His energy was terrible. He always had his head down and acted as if Michael and I were his adversaries, not his teammates. Clyde didn't fit in with the whole team, and it was a shame. The Dream Team had a definite hierarchy, as there is on any team. It went like this. Magic and Larry at the top. Michael one rung just below. Give Michael credit. He deferred to Magic and Larry, letting them share the honor of being co-captains. Michael was the best player in the game, but Magic and Larry had paved the way for Michael. The NBA wasn't very popular before those two arrived in the fall of 1979. The finals, were often shown on tape delay after the 11 o'clock news. That didn't change for good until the Lakers played the Sixers in 1982. Seeing Magic on the court again, where he belonged, gave everyone a lift. There was a time we didn't think that would ever be possible. He was the same Magic from before the HIV diagnosis, firing up his teammates, talking trash, making those behind-the-back passes no one else could make. Having more fun playing the game of basketball than a person has any right to have. Larry, on the other hand, was in pain every day. Some days he could barely move. Having experienced my share of back problems, I thought it was a miracle he was out there at all. He would retire later that summer at the age of 35. Like Magic, Larry was a master at talking trash. His digs often revolved around which of us had championship rings and which did not. Thank God I had a couple by then, so I didn't have to be one of his victims. 7 of the 11 veterans on the Dream Team didn't have rings, one of them being Patrick Ewing. Yet Larry and Patrick became good friends, a white guy from Indiana bonding with a black guy from Jamaica. Go figure. They sat together every morning in the breakfast room at the hotel, cracking each other up over the silliest things. The rest of us referred to the two as the Harry and Larry Show. How Patrick got the name Harry is beyond me. I also made a new friend, Carl Malone. The two of us had much in common. Carl, too, was from a small town in the South, Summerfield, Louisiana, was the youngest child in a large family. He had 8 brothers and sisters, and went to a school, Louisiana Tech, that didn't exactly have NBA scouts lining up. He was the best power forward in the league, and it was no accident. I never saw another human being with a body like his, as if he were carved out of a rock. Carl didn't take a day off. Spending time in the gym with him, I didn't realize anyone could work that hard. I couldn't have gotten more prepared. Having played so recently in the finals also worked to my advantage. I was in excellent shape coming in. I would have to be. As CM Newton explained to me one day, Larry and Magic are getting up there a bit, so we are going to be relying on guys like you, Michael, Charles, guys who are younger, to carry this ball club. No problem, Mr. Newton. We'll be ready. However, no matter how serious we were, we made sure to have a good time. Many days after practice, Charles, Michael, Magic, and I ordered some food and met in Magic's room to play tunk. We played for hours, sometimes until 5 in the morning, for $500 per game. I didn't make a fortune. I didn't lose a fortune either. As exclusive as this group was, not once did I feel the urge to pinch myself. I deserved to be there as much as they did. After a few days in Southern California, we headed to Portland to play 6 games in something called the Tournament of the Americas. Teams needed to do well there to qualify for the games themselves. Our first opponent was Cuba. We won by 79 points. I would be lying if I said I was surprised. we were that much better than anyone else. The next day, we took on Canada. The game was closer. We won by 44. After leading by only 9 late in the first half, what was wrong with us? The team went on a 13-5 run to go up by 17. We put the Canadians away in the first few minutes of the second half. Over our next 4 games against Panama, Argentina, Puerto Rico, and Venezuela, the average margin of victory was 46 points. Finishing 6-0, we booked our ticket to Barcelona. Here's the amazing thing. The guys were still learning how to play with one another. Just think how dominant we would have been with another week or two of practice. In La Jolla and Portland, I felt I was as much of an Olympic athlete as Carl Lewis and Oscar De La Hoya. Though not until I left the country did it hit home how big of a deal this whole dream team thing was. That I wasn't playing for the Chicago Bulls. I was playing for the United States of America. Wherever we went, people waited for hours to catch a glimpse of the famous Americans. I didn't feel like a basketball player. I felt like a rock star. One night in Monte Carlo, the team went to a dinner hosted by Prince Rainier. That's the man who had been married to the late American actress Grace Kelly. Safe to say, meeting a real prince wasn't something that happened every day to a kid from Hamburg, Arkansas. Guy spent a fair amount of time playing blackjack at the casino or hanging out on the beach. I had never been to the beach before. I couldn't believe how beautiful the women were and that many of them were topless. However, when I think of Monte Carlo, I don't think of the prince or the casino or even the women. I think of the game one day in practice between the blue team, led by Magic, which included Barkley, Mullen, Robinson, and Leitner, and the white team led by Michael. Of all the basketball that was played from La Jolla through Barcelona, the game in Monte Carlo was at a level beyond anything else. The Last Dance captured it well. The trash-talking between Magic and Michael, and how Michael's team, which I was on, the other 3 players were Larry, Carl, and Patrick, came back to win. What the doc could not capture, no footage possibly could, was what it felt like to watch the best players in the world put their heart and soul into a game that meant nothing and everything. It was as if we had gone back in time to when we were boys on courts such as Pine Street, playing for the pure love of the game. The game that gave us a life even more amazing than the one in our dreams. From Monte Carlo, we went to Barcelona, and what we saw when we got there, I will never forget. The plan was to enter the city from a remote location to avoid any crowds. The security from day one, as you might imagine, was always a top priority. And this was nearly a full decade before 9/11. None of us could go anywhere without an officer tagging along. The plan didn't work. When we arrived at the airport, roughly an hour outside town, people were everywhere. The official estimate was 4,000. It seemed like 400,000. We took a bus into the Athletes' Village, escorted by about a half dozen police cars and a police helicopter. After getting off the bus, we went to the building where we picked up our credentials. Dream team or not, we needed to go through the same process as every other Olympic athlete. I wouldn't have wanted it any other way. Barcelona was a blast. Some nights, Charles and I went for long walks along Las Ramblas, a well-known tree-lined pedestrian street in the central part of town that was packed with locals and tourists. I never went for walks like that in Chicago. On July 26th, we played our first game. The opponent was Angola, a country on the west coast of southern Africa. I crack up every time I think of the famous quote from Charles. "I don't know anything about Angola," he said at a press conference, "but Angola's in trouble. Big trouble." Dream Team 116, Angola 48. That included a run of 46-1, which was a combination of us being awesome and Angola being, Well, Angola. That was also the game in which Charles slammed his elbow into the chest of a 174-pound player, Herlander Coimbra. Charles caught a lot of heat for that. I thought the whole incident was blown way out of proportion. Charles didn't hit him very hard. Next up was Croatia. I have been looking forward to this matchup since the schedule came out in early July. Croatia was the team Tony Kukoc played for. You know, the guy Jerry Krause was in love with. As with Isaiah Thomas, this is another subplot of the Dream Team that has received a ton of coverage, almost as much as the games themselves. What has been reported for years is absolutely true, that Michael and I set out to make things difficult for Tony by hounding him every time he touched the ball. He finished with just 4 points on 2 of 11 from the floor and committed 7 turnovers, resulting in another blowout for Uncle Sam, 103-70. However, there was nothing personal between Tony and me. How could there be? I didn't know the guy. Tony and I would get along quite well once we became teammates in 1993. People don't realize how good he was. We wouldn't have won our last 3 championships without him. It was personal between Jerry and me. Extremely personal. I was still angry with him for flying to Europe in pursuit of Tony while leaving my contract situation up in the air. There seemed no end to the amount of ways Jerry would insult me, and Michael for that matter. We were the ones busting our butts night after night, year after year for the Chicago Bulls, not Tony Kukoc. The next 5 games, against Germany, Brazil, Spain, Puerto Rico, and Lithuania, were as lopsided as the others. Only Puerto Rico came within 40 points. Finally, the big day was here. All that stood between us and the gold was another meeting with Croatia. Again, no contest, 117-85. Give Tony credit. He put the 2-for-11 embarrassment behind him and came up with a solid performance, 16 points and 9 assists. For us, Michael led the way with 22 points, while Patrick added 15 along with 6 rebounds. I finished with 12 points, 4 assists, and 2 steals. Before long, I was standing on the podium with my teammates, listening to the Star Spangled Banner, a gold medal wrapped around my neck. I was overcome with emotion. For years, I watched athletes, male and female, in moments like this in the Summer and Winter Olympics, wondering what they were feeling. Now I knew. There was no feeling like it. That includes winning an NBA championship. I'm proud of my role on the Dream Team. I led us in assists with nearly 6 a game and played tough defense. I wanted to shut down everyone, not just Tony. More important, I'm proud of the role we as a team played in helping to make the game popular throughout the globe. That is our legacy more than the medals we took home. Many of the international players who came into the NBA in the late 1990s and ever since fell in love with basketball by watching us in the 92 Olympics. Today, nearly 30 years later, when I run into other members of the Dream Team, we reminisce about those days. The Harry and Larry Show, playing Tonk in Magic's room, the scrimmage in Monte Carlo, the night we won the gold. These guys feel like teammates, even if we were together for only a short time. What a time it was.